This weekend, as college students around the country were handed their diplomas, teaching assistant Hannah Clark attended graduation at Creighton University, a Jesuit school in Omaha, Nebraska, and she had a rare honor at the ceremony.
We have a heritage edition of the St. John's Bible, which is the first hand-inscribed and hand-illuminated Bible since the invention of the printing press. It's a beautiful book, and it's my job to walk down the aisle holding the Bible in the graduation ceremony.
For Hannah, who graduated from school herself not too long ago, this honor also came with a bit of irony.
I'm holding a book worth six figures in a graduation surrounded by students who I'm sure have accrued a lot of debt to be at that school. And I just hope that they and I can get out from under that debt and do so in time to make enough wealth to have a future and that our children could have a future.
Today on The Takeaway, measuring our wealth and why it's so hard for so many Americans to accrue any at all.
I don't want to pass on debt. I don't want my legacy to be in the negatives. You know, I want it to be something special and beautiful like the Bible that I'm carrying, not the debt that I'm carrying.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. How much are you worth? Not how much you earn in your paycheck, but how much are you actually worth when you add up your salary, what you own, your assets, your investments, minus what you owe?
I have about $2.5 million in assets.
Net worth, $150K.
I have no, quote, wealth.
If I had more than that money, I wouldn't know what to do with it.
Since the Great Recession and even before, it's been a challenge for Americans to accrue wealth. Over the past half century, one percenters have seen their wealth increase sevenfold. Families in the top 10% have seen fivefold increases in wealth. Those in the middle doubled their wealth, but those at the bottom of the wealth distribution went from having no wealth to being in debt. Throw race into the equation, and the disparities are enormous. Today, we start with two stories of trying to build wealth. The first is Hannah Clark, who we heard from at the top of the show. She's a 25-year-old teaching assistant at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, and a Takeaway listener.
Well, I remember when I graduated and I felt such pride because I had only accumulated about $20,000 in student loans. And compared to my friends who had gone to larger institutions and didn't have as many scholarships, you know, they were racking up hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. And I then looked at my wealth and my projected income, because I want to be an English teacher. And I realized that I wouldn't be accruing wealth. I wouldn't be raising my net worth above the negative for at least 20 years or more. So I was kind of looking at living life in debt for at least half of my life. It wasn't a very optimistic realization.
And you mentioned the $20,000 in student loan debt. I took out about $25,000 myself for a graduate degree. That was more than 10 years ago, and I'm almost seeing the end of paying that off right now.
Congrats.
Yeah, so it's doable, but it's difficult. Let's talk a little bit about your wealth. Like, would you be comfortable sharing a little bit about either how much you owe, how much of that wealth you think you have? You think you're at negative wealth, zero, a little bit above that?
Absolutely. You know, I don't have a lot of illusions about my wealth. I am in the negative. I earn about $2,000 a month, and that's with teaching. And then I have two other part-time jobs that I do on the side. And I don't own any assets. You know, I don't have an inheritance. I basically am hovering on kind of this bubble of debt that allows me to do my job and have a car and rent a place to live. But ultimately, if the dues came up, if something happened and someone said, you need to get this book to zero, I couldn't do that. I'm at least $20,000 negative when it comes to how much wealth I have, which is a weird idea to think about. Like, the word wealth, it just sounds like I'm talking about a king or a landowner, but it's the whole idea of personal ownership and that we should be able to accrue things and value that we can pass on to other generations so that, you know, we don't have to start from scratch over and over again. And I'm not starting from scratch. I'm starting from negative. It's a very strange feeling.
I mean, it sounds like you worked really hard. You went to school. You did all the things you're supposed to do. And now you're working three jobs. I mean, yeah, does that fit with your notion of the American dream?
Not really. As a English major, you look a lot at the progression of the American dream and how it went from, you know, the sort of Steinbeck people crossing, trying to get to California in the Dust Bowl up to the 1950s, where it was the house and the white picket fence. And my American dream is to just have enough money to exist and not have to fear that that existence is going to be endangered if the people that I owe money to are suddenly decide to call up the debts. So I am a little disillusioned.
Tell me a little bit about how your current financial situation and the wealth that you find yourself lacking in many ways is affecting how you make decisions for your future.
I was always very hesitant to pursue the goal of being an English teacher. When I told people majoring in English, they would always give me that look and say, oh, what are you going to do with that? And I'm a firm believer that you can do many things with any kind of degree. And it really matters more about, you know, the work that you're doing and the kind of also environment that you're in. But moving forward, I have, you know, my parents' medical bills continue to increase. I'm choosing where I live based on cost of living. I'm still heavily weighing the choice of being an English teacher because of job market prospects and how I will be asked to pay off this debt for a large part of my life, and I'll probably accrue more. It seems like, at least here in America, if you want to play the game, you have to borrow money and you have to get into debt.
If you could talk to the federal government, if you could talk directly to the president or even your local and state government, do you think they have a role in helping to fix this? And if so, what would you like to see?
If I could talk to someone who could change the current situation, I would ask them to take a long look at the amount of debt that they are burdening the next generation with, and to look beyond their own wealth and consider the wealth of the entire country, because the next generation of workers are the wealth of the country. They are the people that are working to keep the economy alive, to keep culture and society functioning, and they can't do that if all of their money is going to pay off exorbitant educational costs. It's just not a sustainable system.
From English teacher Hannah Clark, we now go to Julia Hinderly, who's 35 years old and lives in St. Paul, Minnesota. Julia's a truck driver, and that might not be the image you have in your mind when you think about people with wealth, but Julia does have wealth, and it's thanks to money that's been passed down through generations.
A lot of people get down on government programs. Even people that I work with, people like me, don't necessarily think about how those government programs might have benefited them through their generations. And then one of the government programs that I know benefited me and my grandparents was the GI Bill, and also being paid certain money from the government during World War II. Some of my grandparents were POWs, and so they got sort of a severance pay from the government after World War II was over and they were freed from POW camp. And I know that the GI Bill wasn't something that was equally distributed amongst all people. I think if you were a person of color, you basically got no benefit from it. So when you look at generational wealth and the disparities that still exist today, you can point to all kinds of reasons. And that's definitely one of them, that the service members of color weren't compensated the same way that white service members were.
And when you think back on that, particularly the how service members of color and people of color, particularly Black Americans, were left out of these, you know, really able to take advantage of these programs, does that change anything about the way you think about wealth?
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of the opportunities that I have, I don't feel like I necessarily deserve what wealth I have and what wealth I grew up with. I don't know. It's like you want to feel like, oh, I worked hard for this money. And you can say, yeah, I worked hard for this money and my parents worked hard for money and my grandparents worked hard, but they're given an extra leg up.
And where do you think you'd be without it, like your family, if they didn't have access to the GI Bill? Do you ever think about how things would be different?
I guess, yeah. It put my grandfather through college. My parents were able to buy a house with help from their parents. They were given help to buy a business. I now am living a pretty comfortable life because of that financial stability within my family. I was able to do a lot of seasonal work and a lot of living all over the place. And if I hadn't known that I had family to go back and crash at their house, then I wouldn't have been able to do any of that before eventually settling down myself.
And really what you're talking about in terms of wealth, and I think one of the big misconceptions about it is it's different from income, and wealth is sort of a cushion, right, that allows you to sort of say, okay, I can take a chance, right?
Exactly. It's a safety net, or it's a net you can, if you know that you have a net underneath you, so you feel a little bit more comfortable walking on the tightrope.
Now let's talk a little bit about you, Julia. Tell us what your current job is, what's your current income level, if you don't mind sharing that with us. And then have you ever tried to figure out your own personal net worth?
So my job is, I'm a truck driver. My income is between $35,000 and $40,000 a year. I've looked into what my own net worth is as far as, you know, if I look at all my bank statements and what little I've got, you know, a retirement account, I don't know, maybe $40,000. But if I were to liquidate all of my assets, I could put a down payment down for sure.
And how does that situation compare to your peers? You're 35, single, live in Minnesota. How does your wealth situation compare to your peers?
It's all over the place. I mean, I have peers who are very, very much in debt. And one of my big advantages is that I was able to go to a state school. I paid $4,000 a year for college. And a lot of my peers have a lot more school debt than I do. Then I have other friends who do more corporate jobs and do pretty well. So I'm probably on the lower end or the middle of different groups of friends and different people, different peers, different coworkers. A lot of my coworkers do own property and I don't. But I guess it's a luxury that I haven't felt financially insecure, even if I'm poor. I've had like the luxury of being poor because my family has been wealthy enough that I know that I have a cushion if I were to need it.
It's a critical thing to have, especially these days. Julia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzina. I appreciate it.
How does someone like Hannah Clark, the English teacher with $20,000 in debt working three jobs, get to be more like Julia Hinderle, the truck driver who says she's living a comfortable life, though her salary alone might qualify her as poor? Chuck Collins wrote a book called Wealth and Our Commonwealth, and he's the director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. According to Chuck, the challenge of building wealth for those who don't already have it has become a lot harder than we've seen in a long time.
Typically, and this is really since, you know, World War II, people over their lifetimes accumulate wealth and savings and assets, and over multiple generations, as people get older, they get more wealth. What we're seeing is that the millennial generation may be the first generation that overall as a group doesn't do as well as their parents' generation.
And what about race? How does race factor in? We know there is a gigantic racial wealth gap, right?
Yeah. And of course, this is one of the ways where, you know, four generations of or going back even to, you know, prior to the formation of this country, the legacy of racism in wealth building shows up in the present. So what does that mean? Well, today, the median white family wealth is 35 times the median black family, 25 times the median Latino family. That's a trend that cannot be simply explained by differences in individual effort. This is the legacy of racism and white supremacy in wealth building.
In the United States, it feels like there's this myth of meritocracy, right? Particularly when it comes to wealth, that people just work really hard and you get what you deserve. But we're seeing that that's not necessarily true.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way you can explain, for instance, that racial wealth divide in a simplistic meritocracy story. And yet, I think that that mythology of deservedness and meritocracy is the single biggest obstacle we have to really facing the dangers of these extraordinary wealth inequalities that we're living through. One out of five households in the United States has zero or negative wealth. 30% of African American households, zero or negative wealth. And then what we're seeing is this extraordinary concentration of wealth and power at the top.
Chuck, we spoke to two listeners who called in to talk about their wealth. One of them is 25 years old. She lives in Omaha, Nebraska. She's a teacher's assistant, and she recently graduated with tens of thousands of dollars in student debt, which is a common story these days. Her dad is a military veteran with disabilities, so most of her family's expenses go to that. How is that or her story indicative of so many young people's struggles with wealth today?
The scourge of student debt is one of the reasons why millennials are having a harder time getting ahead. They're unable to save. It's a striking contrast, again, to the post-World War II era when we as a society made some substantial public investments primarily aimed at building a white middle class. But there's generations walking around who went to college in the 60s and 70s and got a free public higher education or very low-cost public higher education. And we've allowed this situation to get away from us. The average student debt is like $37,000.
Chuck, we got another call from a listener named Julia, and she told us that her grandparents got money from the GI Bill to help build her family's wealth, which had been passed down to her. But we don't see a lot of this happening in non-white families, right?
That's right. I mean, this is a great example, and I can speak personally as someone I would describe as being born on third base, is you can go back a couple generations and see how something like the GI Bill, the Veterans Administration, VA mortgages, Farmers Home, FHA mortgage insurance, these low-cost mortgages enabled tens of millions of people to get on the wealth-building train. But because of the legacy of racism and discrimination, a lot of people of color, blacks, Latinos, First Nations folks, were left at the station waiting for the train that never showed up. Today, someone wants to buy a house, they have to go out into this complicated, somewhat predatory mortgage market and try to find and shop around and find a good deal, just like getting a student loan, 15 varieties. But that was not the case for a previous generation. People just got low-interest mortgages, access to college, and that launched another generation. And I think it's important to say we can do that again.
So that's my next question is, what is the federal government's role in trying to close this gap? And how effective? I mean, let's be honest. I don't know if wealth inequality is at the top of the list of priorities for this current administration.
Well, it's not on this administration isn't concerned about it. In fact, it seems to be compounding it with the current tax cut. But the U.S. public and public opinion really is very concerned about these wealth inequalities that we're talking about. I mean, people widely support restoring the progressivity of the tax system. You know, there's a group in California that's pressing to fund public higher education by bringing back a tax on inheritances. So I think there's a growing movement in states to do this, and I think there's an undercurrent of pressure pushing up to reverse these extreme inequalities.
Let's say we are unable to do that and these extreme inequalities grow. What do you see being the impact of that long term?
Well, we're already an economic and racial apartheid society, but we will only move more in that direction. The French economist Thomas Piketty says we're moving toward becoming a hereditary aristocracy of wealth and power, where the sons and daughters of today's billionaires will dominate our economy, politics, culture, and philanthropy. So play this out. If we don't intervene to reverse these extreme inequalities, we're going to become more polarized, more unstable. And I argue it would be bad for everyone. We like to think, oh, this is good for rich people. But actually, extreme inequality creates economic volatility, social unrest. It undermines the quality of life and public health for everyone. So it's really in no one's interest to just keep going on autopilot the way we are.
Chuck Collins is the co-editor of inequality.org at the Institute for Policy Studies and the author of Born on Third Base. Chuck, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tanzina.
My name is Justin Cockett. I'm calling from Brooklyn. It's difficult to determine, especially poor people, your financial status in the future because there are so much hidden fees stacked against poor people. My insurance was moved from $290 to $440 without my knowledge, just because they say I drive my car too much. I put too much mileage in it for the year. So you cannot determine your financial future. There's just too much hidden fees.
This is Lorna Lynn from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. My parents helped me as much as they could with my educational expenses. I earned an MD and have been well paid in that field. So some family support, some borrowing for my degree, and then hard work in a field where I am lucky to be well compensated.
My name is Robert. I'm an African-American gentleman, 50 years old. Living in Providence, Rhode Island. I'm a teacher by trade. I've been in education for about 25 years, but I use property investment. I know my net worth is exactly $750,000.
We're taking your calls all week on wealth. And when we come back, we'll cover the opening of the American Embassy in Jerusalem.
Hey, thanks for checking out the Takeaways podcast. I know there are like hundreds of podcasts out there, so we really appreciate you choosing ours. And if you like what you hear, why not help spread the word? Like I said, a lot of podcasts, and you leaving us a rating or a review on iTunes will definitely help us stand out from the pack. Thanks in advance. Now back to the show.
More than 40 Palestinians were killed earlier today and at least 1,000 injured as protests intensified along the border fence between Israel and Gaza. Israeli soldiers fired on Palestinian demonstrators there who are opposed to the move of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. To get a sense of the scene on the ground, I spoke with Nidal Mughrabi, a senior Reuters correspondent based in the Gaza Strip.
Today, the Palestinians prepared the largest demonstrations to protest, you know, the U.S. Moving the embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv, and also as part of the marches dubbed as the Great March of Return to demand the right of Palestinian refugees and their descendants to return to lands inside historical Palestine or inside what is Israel today. Tens of thousands have shown up for these protests, with many, or let's say hundreds, you know, advancing towards the, you know, the frontier, some hurling stones, other rolling burning tires. The Israelis, you know, according to human rights organizations, according to local residents and organizers, you know, have used intensive gunfire against the protesters.
Why is the Israeli military responding to protesters with deadly force? I mean, we're seeing a pretty high death toll.
Yes, the Israelis, you know, like said that they will not allow any breach of the border. But human rights organizations have criticized Israel's excessive use of force. And, you know, they have urged, you know, frequently the Israeli army for restraint.
And do you expect protests to intensify heading into the rest of the week?
It was intended for 6 weeks, so supposedly it should be ending tomorrow. But given what happened today, I will not be surprised if the National Committee, which is steering these protests, would extend, you know, these protests and would announce that these protests will go on for some more time.
Nidal Mughrabi, a senior Reuters correspondent based in the Gaza Strip, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Violence is expected to continue along the Israel-Gaza border, but in the capital, the ceremonial opening of the U.S. Embassy continued as planned.
Today, the embassy of the most powerful nation on earth, our greatest ally, the United States of America, today its embassy opened here.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu there speaking at the embassy opening. Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor, also addressed the crowd.
By moving our embassy to Jerusalem, we have shown the world once again that the United States can be trusted. We stand with our friends and our allies, and above all else, we've shown that the United States of America will do what's right, and so we have.
For leaders of the U.S. and Israel, the Jerusalem embassy opening was a celebration. But for residents of the ancient city, the greater concern is the timing of this move, which comes on the eve of Nakba, a day when Arabs commemorate the loss of the land they see as their own.
I'm feeling upset. Upset because it makes a lot of trouble here in Jerusalem, in Israel. We don't feel safe in this country.
Well, I think in theory it's very exciting, but practically, as a resident of the city, and in particular a resident of the neighborhood where the embassy is going to be, I'm a little concerned about how it's going to mess up traffic and the security requirements that they're going to be imposing and how that's going to affect the day-to-day lives of the residents of the neighborhood.
All the time there is all the important people, they come to Jerusalem to visit the government, they give it, they visit the prime minister.
So you don't think it's a big difference?
No.
Noga Tanopolsky is a freelance correspondent based in Jerusalem, and she spent the weekend talking to residents about the symbolism of the move and the risks of violence.
I think that it's basically what both the Hamas organization that rules Gaza was threatening and what the Israeli army was warning of, which was a real significant uptick in the violence today. And I think, depending how this goes, it could really mar the sort of festive vibe that they are putting together in Jerusalem.
And tell us about the scene today. What's the mood at the site of the new embassy?
The mood, I think you could divide it into two. There's a mood of kind of your, I would say, average everyday Israelis who feel, I have to say, a surprising sense of validation and almost palpable relief. It may say more about me than anything else that I was surprised, but Israel has used Jerusalem as its capital in every sense, in terms of a parliament and a Supreme Court and ministries, forever. And so I've been a little bit surprised to see how meaningful this embassy announcement has been for Israelis who really feel a kind of breath of recognition that I didn't realize was missing from them. That's one part of it. The other part, I would say, is a very festive atmosphere by several hundred supporters of President Trump in particular, many of whom have flown in specifically for this event. I'm surrounded by them right now. There are about 800 people gathering around me here.
And what about the Palestinian perspective?
So the Palestinian perspective is interesting. And I have to say that most of the Palestinian Jerusalemites who I spoke with seemed a little bit indifferent and sort of said, if the embassy's in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, who cares? But there was a feeling of resentment that the United States from far away seems to be sort of pulling the strings of their daily life. And that really came up in several conversations.
Noga Tanoparsky is speaking to us from the new U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, and she spent the weekend speaking to residents of the city. Tell us what's next for the city.
I think the next few days will tell. It's, I think, going to be a tense time. Jerusalem so far has remained very calm during a period of up to 2 months now when protests have been growing week by week on the Gaza border. But this embassy move is viewed as a real provocation. Then tomorrow is the day that Palestinians mark as Nakba Day, or the Day of the Catastrophe, when they mark their dispossession of their lands when Israel was founded in 1948. That day is always a hot spot. And then this year, by strange coincidence, the holy Muslim month of Ramadan starts one day after that. So we kind of have a parade now of 3 days, each one of which could be very, very volatile. And I think we don't know yet how the city of Jerusalem will react.
Noga, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Noga Tarnopolsky is a freelance correspondent based in Jerusalem. Iraqis went to the polls in parliamentary elections Saturday, the first election since U.S.-backed Iraqi forces drove the Islamic State from the country. The vote count is still underway, but early results place Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr in the lead. Meanwhile, the incumbent Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi is all the way back in third. Hind Hassan is in Baghdad covering the elections for Vice News. Hind, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about Muqtada al-Sadr.
Muqtadir al-Sadr is a Shia cleric who's really well known in Iraq, but unlike other Shia clerics, he does have a different take on certain things. For example, he's one of the few who actually openly opposes any form of Iranian interference. He was very vocal against American interference. He puts them both on a platform. So when he talks about Iranian interference, he always mentions also US interference and how they've rejected that. He comes from a long line of Shia clerics. During Saddam's time, they were persecuted. His father is alleged to have been killed by Ba'athists. But after 2003 and the US-led invasion and the destruction of the structures in Iraqi society, Muqtadir al-Sadr became one of the most vocal voices speaking against US intervention and US interference in Iraq. And a militia group called the Mehdi Army, which was supporting Muqtadir al-Sadr, began this attack against US troops. And so, you know, after 2003, on a number of occasions, there were a number of clashes between militia groups who supported Muqtadir al-Sadr and the US Army. He did take a break from politics at one point. He left the country, but he returned in 2017, in April 2017. And since then, he's rebranded himself as this really credible politician and as somebody who is the answer to the allegations of corruption and people's feeling of disenfranchisement and that they've been neglected by the government. And he's offered an alternative to some Iraqis who seem to have taken him up on his offer.
And is that alternative as a result of the fact that voters were unhappy with the leadership of Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi?
I think there are a number of factors that's played into this. So at the moment, there seems to be a lot of frustration about allegations of corruption that's taking place. So we've had 15 years since the US-led invasion. You've had four different elections that have taken place, despite what seems to be an improvement in security and despite the defeat of ISIS. People here say they are still exhausted. They're fed up with the situation, the lack of healthcare, the lack of services, the lack of any improvement in education. And they put the blame at the feet of politicians who they say are corrupt and who've been embezzling funds. When we went out to the polling stations on Saturday and spoke to voters who had gone out to vote, we said to them, you know, why are you voting? And most of them said, you know, we want to bring change, but we don't know if this is going to happen because we're so frustrated at what we've seen over the past 15 years. And so it appears as though that a lot of those who came out to vote decided to vote for something different, an alternative, something new. But then there's also the issue of the fact that not as many people turned out for the vote this time as they did in 2010. Now, you did expect after the defeat of ISIS, after politicians claimed victory that ISIS had been defeated and that they were no longer, you know, controlled parts of Iraq, that people might be more positive or might want to come out and vote. But actually, the government is putting its own estimations at how many people turned out to vote at 44.5%. But in different regions, it's even lower than that, which is actually the lowest turnout that's ever taken place in Iraqi elections since 2005.
And what about women candidates? How do they factor into the results?
Well, interestingly enough, a lot of women stood in this election at the beginning, and 83 seats in parliament are set aside for women. It's 25% of parliament is actually set aside for women. There's a quota. But what happened during the election campaign was there were a lot of scandals that came out about women. There were sex videos that were released. There were pictures of women in compromising positions. And because honor is such a big deal in Iraq, the woman's honor and how she fits into the family and the role that she plays, this undermined a lot of the candidates' credibilities. And in fact, I think it was two politicians that were running under Haider al-Abadi, the current prime minister's list, were forced to resign as a result of it. Now, of course, women's rights activists have condemned this and they said that women have been set up, they're being specifically targeted, the same rules aren't applied to men.
I was just going to ask you, I'm not hearing the same thing coming out about any male candidates.
No. And apparently, you know, speaking to some of the journalists in different parts of Iraq, they tell me that there have been some videos released of men, but it just doesn't have the same impact on society because here it is still a very conservative society in terms of a woman and her honor. And her honor is directly linked to the family. So anybody who may undermine that is also undermining and attacking the family. When we were in Mosul, pictures of women candidates were everywhere. You could see them, you know, with every male candidate, there was a female candidate. And that it was quite a good feeling to see how many women were taking part in the election. But as the campaign progressed and these scandals came out, or so-called scandals, it was, I guess, for Iraqi people, or women at least, is quite disheartening for them.
And so practically speaking, what happens now?
So we wait for the official results. Once those official results come out, which is likely to be that the Sadrist and Communist coalition have won, then the next part is forming a government. Now, Muqtada al-Sadr will not become prime minister because he didn't actually run as a politician. He just heads the Sadrist group. But it's likely that he could play a very big role in who the next prime minister of the country is. But just because they have come first in the elections does not necessarily mean that they will govern or that they will have a prime minister chosen from their candidates. Previously, Ayad Alawi had come first in the elections. I think that was in 2005. He didn't become prime minister because he couldn't form a coalition. So the next step would be for whoever wins this election, they have to form a coalition. They have to form a government. And if they can't do that, that could be an opportunity for the current government, Haider al-Abadi's list, possibly forming a coalition with another list, perhaps, you know, the Shia paramilitary fighters. They could still return back to the fold and lead the country once again if the Sadr list fails to form any type of coalition with other parties.
Hind Hassan is a correspondent for Vice News Tonight, and she joined us today from Baghdad. Hind, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hey, listeners, it's been great talking with you today. All this week, don't forget, we continue our look at wealth in America. And of course, we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and tell us your stories on building or not building wealth. How much wealth do you have? How did you get it? If you're struggling to build it, tell us why. Again, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll talk more tomorrow.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.